In keeping with our theme for this month's worship and the focus of today's message, the poem I'm about to read asks us to not only pay attention to the world around us, but to do our part in sculpting that world in which we want to live. It's a poem called Processional by a white American female poet, Joanna Klink. If there is a world, let me be in it. Let fires arise and pass. The sky fill with evening air, then sink across the woodlots and porches, the streams thinning to creeks. In winter, there will be creatures half locked in ice, storms blown through iron grates, a drug of whitest ardor. Let the old hopes be made new. Let stacks of clouds blacken if they have to. But never let the people in this town go hungry. Never let them fear cold. If there is a world, let it not be temporary like these vague stars. Let us die when we must, and spinelessness not overtake us, and privation. Let rain bead across tangled lavender plants. If there is a world where we feel very little, let it not be our world. Let worth be worth and energy action. Let blood fly up to the surface skin. If you are fierce, if you are cynical, half-hearted, pained, I would sit with you a while or walk next to you. And when we take leave of each other after so many years, the oaks will toss their branches in wheels of wind above us, as if it had mattered, all of it, every second, if there is a world. Our speaker this morning is Dr. Patricia Kohlberg, the retired medical director of Multnomah County Health Department, which she likes to refer to as the clinics of last resort. Dr. Passy served for more than two decades. She medically ministered to a population of Portland's impoverished within a medical system poorly designed and funded to meet their needs. She and her co-workers were committed, in accordance with our UU second principle, to treat them with equity, justice, and compassion. In agreement with our fourth principle, Dr. Kohlberg tries to find truth and meaning in the excess of suffering she encountered. She reflects on her patients. We have the privilege of being with her as she reflects on her patients this morning. Dr. Patsy, come on up.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Okay, great. I want to say, first of all, that I am going to mention things like sexual assault and other unpleasantries. If that is a problem for anyone, I want to let you know that ahead of time. And then by way of introduction, let me say that to bear witness means to make the invisible visible. It means to bring voice to those who have been silenced. It means to uncover that which has been concealed, and sometimes to bear witness means to discomfort those who are comfortable. They were musicians and journalists, a nurse out of Africa and a fallen man of the cloth. They were a contractor, a house painter, and a professor of mathematics. They were a lawyer from Afghanistan, a pediatrician from Iran, an officer of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, and a mercenary out of the jungles of Central America. Some of them were undocumented, disabled, and unemployed workers. Not many had reached the age of retirement. They had worked on railroads and docks and hospitals and carnivals and factories and fields. They had worked as prostitutes, pimps, pushers, and panhandlers, and some of them still did. They worked any number of low-wage jobs, basically whatever they could get. They were veterans of wars, both covert, legal and covert, and they were veterans of our prisons and our jails. Lewis had been an assistant to Red Skelton. Martin had been a sports coach, but not after he messed with boys. John was a Reed College graduate, but he did not take advantage of the fine education that he got. I worked in a clinic of last resort, and these were my patients. They came from across the street, they came from across the globe, and they came from various places in between. They were the dispossessed of the world. They had lost their fortunes, their homes, their jobs, their families, their communities, their homelands. They had lost their opportunities, their prospects, and their civil rights, or they never had them to begin with. They had lost their health. Some of them had lost their sanity as well. A few of them were so confused, so cognitively disorganized, they were unable to take advantage of the benefits to which they were entitled. I was their doctor, and they came to me for help. Much of the help that they needed, I could not provide. They lived in cheap apartments or the rundown residential hotels of downtown Portland, where the clinic was located, or they lived on the streets. They slept in the back seat of their car, in a tent pitched behind a friend's house, camped out in the outer reaches of Forest Park or in Oaks Bottom, or sleeping on the sofas of friends or family. They slept in doorways, under bridges, on loading docks, in abandoned buildings. They slept in trains and buses and in the libraries. Those who could tolerate the noise and the crowding and the risk of picking up disease would sleep in the shelters. Those who were loath to part from a partner or a friend would have to find somewhere else. Kids were mostly not allowed in the shelters. For the privilege of a place to sleep or for the safety required for sleeping on the streets, many women paid with their bodies. After she was evicted, Jocelyn slept on the sofas of the waiting rooms that were reserved for the patients in intensive care, and she would move from hospital to hospital at calculated intervals in order to escape notice. Frederick somehow dragged a mattress to a hidden spot under an overpass that was not very far from Portland State University. And he lived there undisturbed for years and even cultivated a garden, as it were, in his anteroom. The majority of my patients have been abused, either emotionally, physically, or sexually, as children or adults, or both, at the hands of family, states, and institutions. Many of them abuse themselves as well, usually with alcohol and drugs, some with razor cuts across their forearms or Drano in their vagina. They told me stories from their childhood, from their marriage, from their war years that I could barely stomach to hear. Most were poorly educated. Many of them did not speak English. Some of them did not read. Many were born into wretched circumstance, and nothing ever changed much for them after that. Others were fallen on hard times or hard choices, bad choices, or both. Or they came from countries we invaded, or whose natural resources we exploited, or whose dictators we propped up, or whose civil wars we precipitated, like Iraq, Croatia, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Somalia, Guatemala. But most have been poor their entire lives. Not much ever trickled down to them. Economic boom or bust, it did not matter. They came to the clinic in clothing that was too thin for the cold, or they came in layers of shirts, vests, sweaters, dresses, and pants over saggy long underwear, which was a great strategy for living on the streets. Or they came in clothes that were too heavy for the heat because they were strung out en masse and they were too skinny and they could not stand any cold. They came in long-sleeved shirts in order to hide their tracks. Joyce came in layers of ill-fit, soiled, and cheap clothing, but in her case, I suspected it was a strategy to ward off the voices that terrorized her. A few women came veiled. Older women from somewhere else mostly came in shapeless black dresses, except for Lupe, from Honduras, who favored short-sleeved, bright-colored frocks. Stephanie, too, came dressed completely in black until we hit on a drug regimen that seemed to clear the chaos of her mind and brought some color to her wardrobe. Ronald would come in wide-lapel, double-breasted suits, ties, great big fat ties in loud colors, and a hat feathered at a jaunty angle. And I would tell him that he looked like $1 million, and boy, did he love to hear that. They complained of all the usual things, headaches, backaches, stomach aches, heartaches. They almost never complained of difficulty thinking, although cognitive impairment was distressingly common among them. They did complain that their bones were cold or that insects were living under their skin. Shirley complained that a surgeon had ripped out all of her pelvic organs and had left her with deeply rotting inside. Lois complained that her neighbors were pumping poisonous gases into her vents. Carol claimed that five men had raped her from front and from behind in the middle of the day, in the middle of downtown Portland, in the middle of an alley that did not exist, which fabrication I believe was probably nowhere near as horrific as the abuse she actually suffered as a child and refused ever to speak about. Their complaints were never trivial. To complain about something that does not matter is a privilege that is accorded only those with means. Some patients I saw only once, some I knew for 20 years or more. Mr. Popoff was the oldest at 97, a Russian journalist who had a state-sanctioned job during the Soviet era and who became increasingly paranoid in his old age, and I thought to myself, no wonder. Jamal was the youngest at 16, and he appeared to be a boy, but he said that his body was different, and he was not sure. I suspected a condition of intersex rather than transsexuality, but he was too embarrassed, too frightened to permit me to examine him, and he took off, and I never saw him again. I was amazed at what conditions among the poor could escape the clinical gaze, sometimes for decades. A few of my patients were deaf or blind, and Lita, who'd been sold off by her father to an older man who would tie her to the bed in order to rape her, became mute. Regina had been hysterically blind for years. Over the time she was my patient, she gradually regained most of her vision, and I decided not to take credit. I thought that she decided it no longer suited her to be blind. Tyler, a player of bagpipes, asked me out on a date. He did not know that I was married. I never wore a wedding band, so in some sense the invitation was fair. Reggie offered to be my houseboy in all the ways that you might be thinking right now. He claimed he had experience and knew how to treat a lady right. He was drunk at the time, so I laughed it off. Franklin, however, wrote a letter to me detailing what all he would like to do with me in bed, and we kicked him out of the clinic. Rosalyn suffered a homoerotic obsession with me, which I found out when the psychiatrist called me from the hospital afterwards. That is, after she tried to kill herself, after the last of the many times she called me at home and I hung up on her. Borders were sometimes an issue, or boundaries were sometimes an issue in the clinic. My patients quit smoking, they quit methadone, they quit meth, crack, heroin, cocaine, they quit the boyfriend who was abusing them, they quit hooking, they quit being jerks and tried to be nicer people. Sometimes the quitting would last, more often it didn't. When they disappeared from my practice, it was because they'd been sent up to prison or to a mental institution, or they'd been deported, or they'd moved to a sunnier clime, or they'd gotten a job with health insurance of the type we could not accept. But many times, I had no idea where they had gone. Sometimes we kick patients out of the clinic for good. If they brought a gun to the clinic, if they started a fight in the waiting room, or they threatened the clerks. But we actually put up with quite a bit. A few of them overdosed in the waiting room or the restroom of the clinic, and we revived every single one of them. We actually got pretty good at it. Christine hid inside the playhouse that we kept in the corner for the kids and refused to come out. Ted, who was psychotic, threatened to shoot somebody that he knew, and we had to empty out the clinic and call the police to come collect him. Many more of them threatened to kill themselves, and these ones almost never did. Others would come in cheerful with plans for the future, and then 2 weeks later would blow their brains out. Two of my patients shot themselves. One person hanged himself, and another took a fatal overdose. Two women, two men, all white and native-born. People of color did not suicide as much. And I thought it had to do with expectations, the gap between what you expected and what you got. Those who died nearly always died before their time. They died of liver failure, heart failure, pulmonary failure, kidney failure, failure of the spirit. Not so much of cancer, because that was usually for older people, and my patients didn't always get to be so old. Many were found dead in their beds or lying on the floor. George was found sitting slumped in a chair, stark naked, pushed up against the wall. He was young and apparently healthy. Many of those who died were not the ones that I expected, and this was hard on me. They called me Doc, Doctor, Dr. Colbert, Dr. Patsy, sometimes just plain Patsy. I let them decide. Sometimes a guy would take the privilege of calling me by my given name in order to manufacture a chumminess that he calculated would seduce me into giving him anything he wanted. It was always a guy who did this. I called the patients mostly by their first names, but not always. Sometimes I called them sweetie, and the older I got, the more I did this, and the more I kissed their shrunken or jaundiced cheeks, the more I put an arm around their hunched shoulders. They would regularly stand me up, or they would appear in the middle of a very busy day, demanding my immediate attention to some sort of paperwork, some sort of bureaucratic emergency that they had created through their own procrastination. Not a few of them lied about the pain pills that they were getting from some other doctor, hoping that I would give them some more. Some staggered in drunk, demanding medicine for their alcohol-inflamed stomachs so that they could get on with their drinking. Others badmouthed the staff or verbally abused them to their faces. Horace insisted on taking multiple doses of insulin during the day, despite my dire warnings about how dangerous this was. Melissa demanded an MRI of her chest every 3 months to check on a nodule that had not changed in years. Orson launched into a drug-fueled rant that was so incoherent and so profane, I got up and walked out on him. Still, I always liked my patients, and it troubled me when I did not. I liked my patients because eventually nearly all of them would open their hearts to me, and it was impossible for me to maintain my fury or my frustration when they shared those stories that were closest to their hearts, like the beloved child that had been taken away by the court, or how they had stood age 10 between their mother and the boyfriend who was swinging a golf club at her. They brought me gifts, a bar of peach soap, embroidered linens, Russian chocolate, a houseplant, a pen and pencil set, turquoise earrings, and a mechanical Santa who danced to a Christmas ditty. They drew me pictures in pen and ink. They painted and fired a ceramic plate. They wrote me poems and shot videos of themselves. They composed and framed photographs and collages. They burned their favorite music onto CDs for me. I learned that living in poverty entailed a lot of waiting for the check or the decision to get out of jail, to earn their citizenship, to see the specialist, to get the new pair of glasses, to reach the top of the housing list. They were always in line for something. I learned that living in poverty meant grabbing the good things in life whenever they came along because you never knew when they would come along again. I learned that a long time when you're living in poverty often meant 2 or 3 weeks, that emotional alliances were often sudden, brief, intense, fraught, and sometimes dangerous, that trouble usually bred more trouble, that the dispossessed were smart to guard against their own expectations, that there were some events that people never recovered from, like the loss of a child, and that some people could endure the unthinkable. And I learned that I had never been as brave or resourceful or resilient as my patients were. What I learned was that I had to change many of my assumptions, that people were both more capable than they appeared and at the same time much less. that people out of fear or embarrassment would conceal all manner of things from me, and that some people were exceptionally good at concealing things from themselves, that people had any number of ways of sabotaging their own chances, that arguing against a fixed idea was like arguing against the sea, it would continue to rush to shore, that bullying a patient into something that he or she did not want was never a good position to put myself in, that some patients would do things for me that they would not do for themselves, and that I owed it to them to exploit that impulse. I learned that meeting people where they are at did not mean letting them walk all over me, that people lied to me much more than I wanted to believe, that when patients became angry with me, it was almost never about me, that being nice was not always the best strategy, that to be a doctor, scientific knowledge was necessary but hardly sufficient, that medicine had its limits and stopped well shy of what it would have taken to fix most of the trouble that I saw, that people were too often fooled into thinking that I had powers that I did not. I learned that making mistakes was inevitable, and I had to come to terms with that or leave medicine. I learned that I, too, could engage in lying and subterfuge if I had to, and that I would feel responsible for every single bad thing that happened to my patients. And this, despite knowing that only a fraction of bad outcomes were due to bad luck or bad genes, and virtually everything else was issued from the depredations of a society that does not privilege the well-being of its members and is exceptionally mean to those most vulnerable among us. I learned that medicine was full of conflict with patients who wanted what I could not give them and did not want what I could. I had not expected that it would be like that. I learned that I was not nearly as tough as I needed or wanted to be, that my own ability to absorb the suffering of my patients would rise and fall in tandem with my capacity to step outside my feelings and reflect on them. I learned to lean on the sage and comforting presence of my colleagues and coworkers. I learned that coming home emotionally depleted was not only hard on me, it was hard on my husband and on my son. That being kind to myself was as important as being kind to my patients. I learned that I had lots to give, that I have myriad ways to lessen the suffering of my patients, that every day my patients and I would enjoy small triumphs and sometimes big ones, that along with the anger and the frustration and the disappointment of doctoring among the dispossessed was wonder and joy and laughter and love. I learned that the best of what I had to give was not advice or prescriptions, or referrals, or information. It was my own self. It was my affection, and my consolation, and my validation, and my respect. It was to stand in unflinching solidarity with my patients. It was to be their witness. Thank you. Sorry, the emotionality wasn't planned.
We have about 10, well, we have a little less than 10 minutes, and I'll bet you have a lot of questions and maybe some comments. So I'm going to come around with the mic and try to get to everybody, and you're going to stay up here and respond?
Yep.
Okay.
You can do that. Great.
If you put your hands up, then I kind of know where I'm going.
Oh, my.
When we get to hear someone like Dr. Patsy Kallberg talk about her engagement with human beings of all stripes, it generates quiet.
It was a moving litany of your life.
Thank you.
The compelling question for me is, now that you're out of that environment, what's it like, and what's next? How can we help?
Be active. There is so much wrong with the world that needs to be changed. I am actually quite happy to be out of the practice. It took a lot out of me. And I'm afraid I don't miss it. It was difficult. And since I retired several years ago, I've really thrown myself into different kinds of ways of being in the world and being with people, including doing some writing workshops at the prison, the women's prison, working at KABU, and doing a lot of work on climate change, because that seems like the existential threat that's out there. And I'll just put in a plug. I don't think we're going to solve the issue of climate change if we don't solve the issue of justice. I think that's just a given. So justice work.
Justice work, indeed. I also want to say that Dr. Patricia Kallberg is the author of two books. One is her memoir called At the Ragged Edge of Medicine. The other is a novel. She is now a novelist as well. And that book is called The Girl in the River. She's currently working on another project, which is about the Vanport flood and that whole community. She's quite the historian.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
A little plug.
I had a question about the practice itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you left the practice, did someone else step in and take over the clinic care? That was my first part of my question. The second part is, where did you get your funding?
The clinics that I worked in, well, was really just one clinic that moved, was part of the primary care system of Multnomah County Health Department, and we had some, as is typical for these kind of agencies, about 80 funding sources, including a number of federal grants to take care of refugees, to take care of Medicaid patients. We had funding for Medicaid, from Medicare, from all sorts of places. We had a staff of, by the time I quit, close to 100 providers. And, yeah, and we had, I don't know, close to 30 clinical sites, ranging from a single provider to the clinic where that I retired out of. We had 6 providers, doctors and nurse practitioners. And they replaced me.
I have an idea.
Okay.
We're running out of time, and I know that questions now are starting to come forward. Would it be okay if we met after we went downstairs, closed the service, went downstairs for coffee, and brought that coffee into Forest Hall and sat with Dr. Patsy?
Oh, I'm happy to. Sure.
Yeah. Yes? Can we do that? All right. Let's do it. Thank you so much for
being here. Thank you for having me.
All right.